We build rules for the capital, for the movement of capital and goods. We created international institutions, the Bretton Woods International Financial Institutions, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariff, later the World Trade Organization, and other institutions that allowed us to regulate the international economic system to huge benefit of Americans and non-Americans alike. We saw in the United States the steady growth of the economy, resulting in the steady growth of income across the board in the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, and onwards. We saw the revival of the European economy and indeed the Asian economy, first with Japan, later of the Asian tigers, and then with China as a result of this liberal economic order. We saw from 1973 to 2008 a doubling of trade as a percentage of the gross domestic product of the world. We saw rapid changes in populations with movements, with immigration, both internally, people moving from the country into cities, rapid urbanization in the West, and an external movement with people moving from the northern, from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere. We've also seen a tremendous reduction in poverty as a result of this open international system. Indeed, a 70% reduction in poverty from 1990 to 2015. In 1990, one in four people in the world lived in abject poverty on less than $2 a day. By 2015, one in 10 people lived in that situation. An astonishing reduction, mostly because of the growth in China and in India, but also in other parts of the world, including in Africa. So as a result of this open international system, we have seen a tremendous explosion of prosperity of the system. And it was the international effort by the United States in creating and maintaining these institutions that made this possible. Second element relates to security. In 1944, FDR worked with colleagues from around the world to create a new international global security system. The United Nations, which was signed in San Francisco, the charter of which was signed in San Francisco in 1945, and sought to create an international security system that would allow for the management of conflict and hopefully the prevention of war, wars that had so devastated all of the world in the previous half century. At the same time, the United States set up a series of alliances across the globe, starting with Europe and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that moved from 12 members in 1949 to almost 29 members this year as Montenegro is set to become its final, its next member. And we did the same in Asia, building bilateral alliances systems with Japan, with South Korea, with the Philippines, with Australia, with New Zealand, alliance systems that allowed the United States to work with its friends across the globe in order to maintain global security, first and foremost in response to the rise of communism, the Soviet Union, of the Soviet Union and of China, and after that to deal with global threats that were emerging around the world. And it was a wildly successful effort in the sense that true great power wars, which had dominated history up until 1945, had been effectively eliminated from our efforts. Politically, a third element, the United States championed democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. It was at the core of a huge wave of democratization that happened from 1945 to 1962, as many countries that were colonies became independent and adopted democratic government. Another, the third wave of democratization occurred from 74 until about 2000, when Eastern Europe, Latin America, and much of Africa and Asia was turning towards democracy. Human rights were not just something we did at home, but were encapsulated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, championed by Eleanor Roosevelt and others. And we put on the map the idea that how one treated one's citizens, how one governed one's country, was important for the security of the world. And we were champions of that effort. And it was the United States that that was the absolute key to this order, not just to creating it, but to maintaining it, not just to shaping it, but making sure it would survive. American leadership, sometimes derided as a Pax Americana, was at the essence of the liberal world order. It was the United States' willingness to bear the burden of global leadership that made it possible for prosperity to occur. We opened our borders and our markets so others could prosper. We provided massive assistance in form of the Marshall Plan and other forms of international assistance, in the belief that if others were rich, then we would be able to export to them, and we would benefit from the fact that everyone would be getting richer as a result. We deployed our troops forward. We provided for the security of our friends and allies, so much so that because we provided for the security, they could change and transform themselves economically. And we maintained and we gave countries a guarantee that we will defend them. We would even defend them using nuclear weapons if it was necessary. That's what we told our European friends. It's what we told our friends in Asia. And it was central to the security system that we would build up. And we led politically. No conflict in the world could be resolved without Americans, diplomats, or an American leadership at the table. We were, as Madeleine Albright said when she was Secretary of State, truly the indispensable nation when it came to the management of global order. So where are we today? I see three big challenges to this order. This order is being challenged from below, it's challenged from without, and it's challenged from within. From below, we see a rise in the Western world in particular of populism and a return to the kind of nationalism that we hadn't seen since really the end of World War II. We see the combination of globalization, of technological change, and the social media creating a very different political environment in many of our countries. Globalization has had huge benefits overall, but it has also led to growing inequality within our own societies, as some have prospered greatly from the openness and others have not. Globalization has also led to large-scale immigration, movement of peoples, and as a result, changes in the way our societies are made up, how we look, how we feel, how we pray, and what we do. Technology has changed the terms of employment, particularly in the lower middle class and the blue-collar area, as more and more automation takes the role of everyday work. Just think what self-driving technology will do in the next 5 to 10 years to the taxi drivers, the truck drivers, the bus drivers that are now having a decent living. You combine growing globalization with growing technological change and social media, where you can mobilize large numbers of people, and you can see how anxiety can quickly, anxiety about the future can be mobilized in an us versus them kind of political way, and people will become increasingly susceptible to either a populist or a nationalist message or both. And we've seen it in our politics here at home. We've seen it in the politics in Europe with the vote on Brexit. We've seen it with the growth of nationalist movements in Hungary and Poland and in the kinds of elections that we will see in the Netherlands and other places. The second major challenge is a challenge from without. And here there are two. First, the growth of revisionist powers, Russia and China, that don't want and are no longer willing to abide by an American-led international order. They don't like the system. They want to establish themselves as stronger competitors, not only of the United States, but of the system that the United States has led. Russia has moved to invade two of its neighbors. It has violated the fundamental tenets of our post-war security system by forcefully changing borders, which hasn't happened since 1945. It has indiscriminately used force in Syria and other places, and it poses a fundamental threat to the security system that we build up with so much effort in Europe. China, which has benefited greatly of an open international system, would like now to form a system that is more conducive to its power and its mercantilist adventures. It's creating a Silk Road, a new Silk Road, both on land and at sea. It is investing massively in Africa, not necessarily to the benefit of Africans, but certainly to the benefit of itself. And it very much would like to establish a control of the Pacific to the exclusion of the United States. So it's a major challenge to the United States coming from Russia and from China. The second challenge from outside is the growth of non-state actors. Increasingly, we see terrorists and terrorist groups, criminal cartels, narco-traffickers, people traffickers who are moving large numbers of people from one place to another, as we saw in Europe in 2015, taking control and undermining the system from the outside. All of which, both the challenge of revisionist powers and the challenge posed by non-state actors, are increasing the burden on the United States of its global leadership. And that's where the third challenge comes, a challenge from within. There is increasing doubt in the United States about the willingness and ability of the United States to continue to bear the burdens of global leadership. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs has been doing opinion polling for more than 40 years, and we see still the majority of Americans wanting to be actively engaged in the world, but that majority is declining as those who want to stay out of the world become an ever larger part of our population. We see a stronger preferences for emphasizing sharing leadership, sharing the burdens of leadership. And indeed, over the last 8 years, we have seen a president pursuing a policy of retrenchment, of reducing our involvement in the world, particularly in the Middle East, but indeed in other parts of the world as well, including in Europe, including in Asia, where despite the proclamation of a pivot to Asia, the actual effort was far less than advertised. That retrenchment was Obama's belief that the American people were no longer willing to carry the burden of global leadership. And the election of Donald Trump indicated that he too was tapping into a strong sentiment that perhaps engaging in the world in the way we had traditionally done was no longer affordable. Now, we can talk in the Q&A about specific foreign policies under the Trump administration, and there's likely to be quite a lot of flexibility in terms of specific policies in the administration. But one thing I think is clear is that Donald Trump came to office with a worldview that has been well advertised for the past 30 years. There's a famous New York Times ad in 1987, which reads very much like the Donald Trump of 2017 in terms of its policies. His overarching belief is that liberal world order that has been so beneficial for so many for so long has been, in essence, a bad deal for America. It's been a great deal for other countries, but not for us. When we look at trade, the trading system has benefited many other people, but at the cost of the United States. Cost of American jobs, cost of American growth, cost of American ability to grow itself. And that NAFTA and other arrangements have all been to the benefit of other participants, but not to the United States. Similarly, that our investment in security alliances has been great for the people whose security we have provided, but has not been a great deal for the United States. That in fact, the United States pays too much for the privilege of others to have the privilege of defending others, and that it is high time that the Europeans and the Japanese and the Koreans start paying not only their fair share, but frankly start paying for their defense. And when it comes to political engagement, it comes to the importance of democracy and human rights. That is not high on Mr. Trump's agenda. His is not a Reagan view of a city on a hill. It is rather that we need to concentrate on what happens here before. And his inaugural address encapsulated that very notion through the concept of America First. So we are, it seems to me, at a logical endpoint with regard to America's engagement. We are at a tipping point. Are we going to go back to a foreign policy in which nation states, large and small, conduct their policies independently without regard to the larger public good that has been at the essence, at the core of our liberal order for so long, in which the United States and Russia and China and Germany and Japan act solely in their own interest in a competitive way? Or are we going to try to find another way to resuscitate our ability to work together with other countries? That's the question. We don't quite know where we're going to end up. It's only been 4 weeks in the new administration, and administrations make change their minds as time goes by. But it seems to me we are at a fork in the road. We can either have the foreign policy that is very traditional, 19th century, early 20th century foreign policy, in which great powers compete for influence, in which they recognize or not each other's spheres of influence, in which we do bilateral but not multilateral security and economic deals. A world that my friend and colleague Robert Kagan, a great scholar at the Brookings Institution, has described as deeply unstable and likely to lead to the kinds of conflicts that we saw in the first part of the 20th century in an article that he entitled The Coming of World War III. Or we can look for a way to try to resuscitate the core element of the liberal world order, and that is to redefine our engagement in the world and focus it on those areas that are most central to our success, our prosperity, and our security, Europe and Asia, to have strong new relationships with our friends in Europe and Asia, politically, economically, and in the security mode. And let me end with this, which is clearly, by the way, my preferred option. And now, as Henry Kissinger said, if you want to get your preferred option in, appeasement, World War III, your option is more likely. I don't know what the appeasement option is. So I just think the World War III and retrying to rebuild our Western, in this case, Western, European and Asian alignment is the right way to go about it. And I would say that Donald Trump has put us in a position to do that in the right way through the campaign and in, at times his denigration of our alliances and of our allies. He has now put us in a position of resetting the possible relationship with our allies and doing it in a way that is more beneficial for the bilateral relationship, perhaps to get the Europeans finally to pay more for their defense, or in fact, to pay for their defense. Finally, to get the Asians to open up their markets in a way that we have done for many, many years, whether it's cars or rice or agriculture or beef or what have you, to have, in some ways, set us on a course where redefining these bargains are possible. And I would hope that that's where we end up, in a new bargain with our European allies and friends, with our Asian allies and friends, so that we can maintain some of the great benefits of the liberal order that have, for the last 70 years, kept us prosperous, at peace, and free. Thank you very much.
So I took the liberty of, there were several questions that were the same, so I'm going to try to wrap them all into a couple of themes that came up. So the first one came up, Ivo, is the theme of populism. And in France, if Le Pen is to win France and Merkel loses Germany, what happens to the European Union? Will it survive? And what is the long-term future of the United Nations?
A lot of questions.
Well, if I grant the assumption, if Le Pen wins in France and Merkel loses in Germany, that's easy. That's the end of the European Union. In fact, if Le Pen wins in France
it will be the end of the European Union. She will have campaigned, just as the Brexit vote in the UK will have campaigned on leaving not just the euro, but the European Union and NATO. And if she gets 50% plus one vote, which is the only way in France that she can actually become president, you actually have to win a popular majority. If she gets that, there is no doubt in my mind that she will follow through on withdrawing from the European Union. And in that case, it doesn't really matter what happens to Merkel. Let me reassure you, I actually don't think she's going to win. She is, at the moment, on the top in the opinion polls, about 27-28%. But you have a runoff where the two largest percentage winners are going to be competing against each other, and a lot of changes in French in French politics right now. But it looks like a young centrist former economics minister in the current government will be the second person in that race and will likely win the election. Future of the United Nations. I've always seen the United Nations really in sort of two different ways. You have the formal United Nations system, a Security Council and a General Assembly, which has always been deeply politicized, in part because of the veto in the Security Council for the first 45 years. It didn't work because the United States and Soviet Union weren't willing to cooperate. It was a small period into the 1990s. It did work, but right now it is back into a basic standoff. But there are other parts of the United Nations. UNICEF, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNESCO, other agencies, the World Health Organization, that as agencies do extraordinarily important work. And we fund these agencies with voluntary contributions. We, the United States, and others do so. And those agencies, particularly when you look at the number of refugees, when you look at the challenge of pandemic diseases, when you look at children and the suffering that they have for no fault of their own, these agencies are doing God's work in a very real way. They're trying to help people. And that part of the system, no matter what happens to the formal part, ought to be a central issue in how we look at the future.
So there were several questions around currency, so I'm going to try to consolidate them. So there were several questions about Brexit, but then there were a couple of others about a future of Russia and China developing their own currency, and what will that do to the U.S. dollar?
Well, excellent question, and I'm not an economist, so I can punt a little bit on that question. I'm not worried about the Russian ruble becoming a reserve currency. I'm much more worried about Russian nuclear weapons and military capability than its economic might. And indeed, I find Russia is a declining power, and declining powers are dangerous powers, which is one of the reasons why I think we are seeing their behavior. The Chinese, however, are also at a crossroads, and clearly they would like the renminbi to become a reserve currency, and they have played this game of do we stay within the accepted liberal international economic order that has been part and parcel of our engagement, the IMF, and other parts, and so far they have one foot in that era. They want more power to reflect their growing economic might. But they are willing, at least feigning to be willing, to stay within that system. But they're also, at the same time, building a new system, one that is really around China. So they set up an Asian infrastructure investment bank a couple of years ago, and they invited other countries to participate. But they are in control. They head it. They put most of the money in it. And indeed, much of the world decided that they were going to be part of that system too, except for Japan and the United States. The same is true with the renminbi, where they are trying to make that a reserve currency and a tradable currency, at least with the people that they want to trade with. So they are setting up an alternative system to the one that we have dominated. And we need to figure out how do we respond to that. Do we make it a competition and see who can win? Or do we try to find ways to pull them back into the international economic system that we have worked for so long to maintain? It's a huge question, and it ought to be at the center of our engagement when it comes to China and its role in the world.
Another kind of financially related question. These are kind of all over the place, but this one is a little bit different. Do you think that the U.S. will ever persuade any of the European allies to contribute 2% of its GDP to NATO and defense?
Well, I spent 4 years and 2 months banging my head against the wall and getting the answer no. Very nice, but you know, we need to, the favorite from the Germans was, can we look not at input but at output measures? Which is, let's not look at how much we spend but how much we provide. And I kept on telling them, the best way to measure output is by having more input. If you want more output, you need more input. And they said, really? No, I said, yeah, really. Actually, that's how it works. It's not always true. Greece spends more than 2% of its GDP on defense. It's mostly pensions. So in that sense, looking at output may be useful. I think there's an opportunity. I was as a former ambassador to NATO, I did not think it was wise for either a presidential candidate or a president-elect to call NATO obsolete. But he did it. Can we use that as a means to get the Europeans to finally step up and start paying more for their defense? I mean, this is an opportunity. General Mattis, our Secretary of Defense, was at the NATO Defense Ministerial meeting earlier this week, and he hammered it away. Now, let me tell you, we've been hammering at the Europeans since 1952, when we all agreed that we needed 96 divisions in the Central Front to defend Europe against the Soviet Union. We never got 96 divisions. We never even got close to 96 divisions. We have threatened to leave NATO. Sam Nunn had an amendment which said that if they don't spend more on defense, we will go and leave NATO. So we've been here before. The only way they're going to spend more than 2% is if Vladimir Putin continues to do what he does. They're scared shit. They're scared. So,
shirtless.
This was on the record, right?
Shirtless, right.
They are scared, and they're right. And they're right to be scared. And as a result, the Germans are now finally starting to increase their defense spending. And that is how we're going to have to do it. We have to convince them that they have to do more, and we need to bang our heads. But saying, go, we're leaving you, and it's all in your hands, we've been there. We fought 3 wars in Europe, one in World War I, one in World War II. And the second and the third one was the Cold War, and we won it without firing the shot because we were there. So I think it's important that we continue to be there, even as we bang our heads against the wall and it hurts, to get the Europeans to do more.
Okay, another question. How concerned should we be regarding Russia's ongoing threat to the Baltics and getting access to the sea?
We should be concerned. I mean, the Russians did something that we didn't think was likely ever to happen again. They invaded a country, took part of it, made it part of their own of Russia. That hadn't happened. When they invaded Georgia, these two parts of Georgia became independent states, recognized by no one but by themselves and by Russia, but they're supposed to be independent states. This was different. Walking into Crimea, taking it and saying it's ours, after having signed an agreement with Ukraine that it was Ukraine's, after the people of Crimea voted in a referendum by well over 55% in 1991 to be wanting to be part of Ukraine, they walked in and took it. And if they can take Ukraine, or part of Ukraine, and they're invaded eastern Ukraine, can't they do the same with the Baltic states? Country of Estonia, 1.2 million people, 35% Russian speakers. Country like Latvia, a little more than 1.5 million people, 35% Russian speakers. The same argument can be there. And that's why we need NATO. That's why it is important that we, the United States, continue to say, we're there to defend you. And guess what? Today, there is a German-led battalion in Lithuania, a Canadian-led battalion in Estonia, a British-led battalion in Latvia, a U.S.-led battalion in Poland. Not because that battalion is going to be enough to defend against a real big Russian invasion, but because for one reason, if they do invade, they're at war with the United States, with the United Kingdom, with Germany, with Canada, and maybe Mr. Putin doesn't want that war. So I think today the defense of the Baltic states is as strong as the defense of West Berlin was during the Cold War. That is, it wasn't defended by troops, it was defended by our commitment. And that's why it's important not only that the Europeans pay more for defense, but that we remind people it's important that we take their defense seriously. Vice President Pence is in Munich today and will meet with the presidents of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and that will be, I have no doubt, his message. And it's extraordinarily important that we keep making that statement, because that's what keeps the Baltics free and the Russians out.
So following up on that, could you talk about who you think Putin's allies are and what levers we could pull to control him?
You know, the reality is he doesn't have allies. I mean, one of the fundamental differences between the United States and Russia and China is we have allies. We have friends. They're on our side. They have nobody. They only have people who are scared, neighbors who don't trust them. And he is trying to undermine our allies. He's trying to weaken our relationship with the Europeans. Why do you think he's interfering in the elections in the Netherlands and in France and in Britain and other places? He wants them to have leaders who no longer want the United States as an ally. Is that good for them, or is it good for Putin? So that's that. And the Chinese, in many ways, are the same. They have no ally. They have no friends. Nobody is walking around saying, I'm so glad that China's in my backyard. And there are a hell of a lot of people walking around saying, I'm not very glad that Russia's in my backyard. So that's the fundamental point. How do we have leverage over them? By having strong allies who are working with us on sanctions, on a strong defense, on making sure that he cannot succeed in his most nefarious efforts, whether it's undermining us from below through the kinds of interferences in elections, or it is trying to undermine us directly through invasion or economic measures. If we stand strong, he will fail, and that requires us to be together with our friends and allies.
So the next question, which is a tie-in to that as well, is, if you think about North Korea and the craziness of its president, do you think there's any collaboration between North Korea and Russia? Or what will China do to try to control the North Korea problem?
So I think North Korea is our most immediate number one security threat. President Obama, as he left, told President Trump that this was going to be his number one crisis. It is a country that is deeply unpredictable. It has nuclear weapons, and it is developing the capacity to deliver those nuclear weapons by missile against the United States. I can't think of anything more threatening than a deranged leader of a country with nuclear weapons that can hit the United States. So this is a big issue. I don't think the Russians are directly helping the North Koreans. I think they would be happy to have this problem resolved. After all, the North Koreans are pretty close to Russia. I think the Chinese are worried about the regime. They're worried about the threat. But they're more worried about the collapse of North Korea. If you are in Beijing, you worry about North Korea collapsing, either a massive war right on your doorstep, or worse, South Korea taking control of North Korea, allied to the United States, and U.S. troops on your border. That's what the Chinese are concerned about. So if we're going to resolve this issue, it's not good enough to say to China, go figure out how to solve this issue, because their interests and our interests, while they're overlap, it's a Venn diagram, they're not the same. And we need to find a policy in which we can satisfy the Chinese that we're not interested in the collapse of North Korea, and certainly not interested in the reunification of North Korea with U.S. troops and the Korean Peninsula. We are interested in eliminating the nuclear threat, first of all to the United States, second of all to South Korea and Japan. And we need to figure, this needs to be a job one, two, three, four for the next administration, because this is the threat that can truly kill millions of people, truly alter the way in which we will relate to the world. This is our number one threat. For 70 years, 70 now 2 years, we have not had a nuclear weapon explode in a war or an anger. And I'd like it to have another 72 years in when that happens. And the North Koreans right now are the biggest challenge to that essential element.
So we've talked about Russia, China, the Baltics, but we have not talked about the Middle East at all. So perhaps you could just give us a few thoughts on what issues that you think with ISIS and some of the other groups, the radicalization, could have, and what should we do?
So I successfully avoided talking about the... time's up. You know, I don't have an answer. I really don't. This is a region that is going through its 30-year war. Europe did that in the 17th century. The Middle East is catching up. It is a region in which tribal and religious conflict is being stoked by the failure of governance. These are countries that have not been governed well, ever. The failure of economic development, which has led to a whole lot of very young men having no prospect for the future, frankly, not being allowed to hang out with girls or anything else, and being just left with only one thing to do, which is to blow themselves up, to become radicalized, to become part of a system in which they no longer value their lives. Because, frankly, if there's no job and there's nothing there, why should you? That's our problem. That's what terrorism is about. It's not just because there are evil people. They are. But what is being fed is a system in the Arab, particularly in the Arab world, that has failed in extraordinary ways. The development of the Arab world is so far behind any other part of the world, economically, politically, socially. And unless we find a way because we can't do it for them. They have to do it. They have to find a way in which they find a way to govern themselves effectively, in which economic development happens that benefits a large part of the society, that doesn't leave 50% of the population in the most discriminatory and abject rejection, as we see. They have to be part of the solution. And if that doesn't happen, then I think it's going to be rough sailing. And I think it's going to be rough sailing no matter what. This is a generation or two it's going to take. There is no simple solution to this. It's not that we can just bomb these people and it will be over. You can't bomb an entire population. At some point, you have to deal with the underlying problems. Frankly, that's easier said than done. It will depend on them doing it. But that's our only hope.
This is the last question. You get a call from President Trump today asking you to be National Security Advisor, assuming you would accept. What are your three top priorities?
Well, I'd have some conversation about the circumstances under which I would accept that role. And it is quite remarkable that a former serving 3-star officer has turned down the job to be National Security Advisor, reportedly because he wanted clarity about where control in the White House lies when it comes to the making of national security policy. It lies with the president, but then whom? And there's no agreement in the administration. There are at least three, if not four, people today in the White House who have equal say over parts of the national security apparatus. And I wrote a book on the national security advisors. It's not the most effective way in which to handle this. But if I could, sort that out, and we could come to an agreement, what are the three things? I think the number one thing, the most immediate thing, is North Korea, in a way, and I talked about that. The second thing would be to rebuild our alliances, our military contribution, and find a way to get the Europeans and the Asians to do more, but make that part and parcel of our containment policy of Russia and our relationship with China. And the third thing is I would try to see what is our long-term strategy that is ultimately going to defeat Islamic terrorism in the world, because and this is what I talked about as well, it has to be long-term. There is a military component to it, and there's a huge intelligence component to it. But there also has to be a component that actually solves the underlying issue within this part of the region.
So I think that concludes our program for today. I would like to thank Ambassador Daldo with a couple of books from the Forum Club on Marco Island and Naples.
Thank you. Thank you.